My name is Ingrid Christiansen, and I am going to read a story by Maxine Chernoff called Bop, and then we'll discuss it. And before I begin to read, I would like to tell you a few things about the story, because I always think it's easier to listen to a story once you've, for the first time, if you know a little bit about things to listen for, and so that you can pick up on them when they happen. It always takes me about three times through a story before I really feel like I know what's happening in it. One thing about the story is that if this is a story, if this is this story, it begins with a vignette or a scene about work and values to do with work and behavior work, and it ends with one. And the next major scene after the first scene and before the last scene, in each of those scenes, a child adopts the major character. And the major character's name is Oleg Lum. He's an immigrant from Russia. And the first female character is Carrie, and her mother is Claire Rem. So I just put those names there to help you with clarification about names. The story is written by Maxine Chernoff, who happens to be a friend of mine in Chicago. She's a Russian Jew, mother of three, wife, English teacher, writer, poet, lots of books out. Here's a picture of her. And I don't know that, I suppose her being a Russian Jew is important because this is about a Russian immigrant. She's a very interesting woman. One thing that I found interesting is what we learn about America in this story by listening to Oleg, the main character, and his comments about America, and then comparing that with the sort of commonplace of America, the framework, and the comments that the two women, or the girl and the woman, make. But what he sees in his point of view, I found very interesting. The others take stuff for granted that, of course, he doesn't. I think an important thing in this story is the role of reproduction or regeneration, life, the life springs, what that's all about. Another very important thing is communication. How do they all communicate among each other? Oleg's communication is interesting, an interesting use of language because he's very bright, and yet he uses language oddly because he's a new immigrant. But various forms of communication, even from the children and the baby, and then communication goes on through, of course, this is America, it goes on through television. And there's a whole series of communicative arts that are discussed in here. The Xerox machine, for example. If she'd written it 10 years later, she would have had a fax in it. Then there is a set of things, including the Xerox machine, that are about light and reproduction of light and image and reality, photography, faxes, stuff like that. One of the things that I kind of think of in that category is that there are mimes in the story. And he can't think of the right name for mimes, so it's sort of interesting to see how that goes. Then it's about freedom and liberation. You know, he came from a country that wasn't free, and this is free, and what he thinks freedom means. What does it mean to a Russian immigrant to be free in this country? And I guess the last thing I want to say about it, there are a couple other things. One is that there's a reference that if you're not from Chicago, you won't understand, and that is that he talks about public art, and the public art that he refers to that's in Chicago is something that we call a bat column. And I wish I could remember the name of the artist, but it's a familiar name. It's a famous artist that Chicago gave tons of money to produce a public art sculpture for the city. We do that in Chicago. We have lots of public art. And this guy produced a baseball bat made out of steel. And it stands, extremely tall. And it stands in a plaza, and it's mesh, steel mesh, and it's a baseball bat. I mean, that's literally all it is. It's a baseball bat. And we call it bat column, trying to be dignified about it. He writes three letters. It's sort of interesting to hear, to think of the three letters as a progression or a relationship among them. I guess the main thing that I feel about the story is that it's really fluid, and it exists in the growing and interaction of the people. It exists in the relationships much more than it exists in any other way for me. Bop by Maxine Chernoff. The machine would not cooperate. It photographed his original, but when Oleg looked in the metal pan, the duplicate was zebra-striped and wordless. Three more times he inserted the grocery ad. He got back stripes leaning toward each other and crossing in the middle like insane skate blades. Please, if you will. It was obvious that the woman wasn't interested in her job. You could tell by the way she handled the paper. Her nails tore the pleasant green wrapping that reminded him of larger American money. Her eyes never met the machine that perhaps needed ink, fluid, straightening, or encouragement. Her behavior wouldn't be tolerated if he ran the place. "Can I ask you something?" she said. "It's a free country. One may ask what one wishes." "You come here every day with something different. I know I'm not supposed to look, but here you are again, Xeroxing garbage, and your machine is acting up. Why do you make me so busy?" "Please, I will tell you. The duplication of materials is of great interest to me. Since I came to this country, for 3 years now, I make copies of everything. If I could, I would copy my hair, my clothing, my food, and my bowels." She had walked away. He left the office carrying the perfect finished copies of the grocery ads. These went into the large books stamped "Souvenirs" purchased from Woolworths. He had filled 14 already. Now he was back in his small apartment, whose attitude toward America was one of total acceptance. Plastic molded coral and gold flecked seats blended with torn leather. A portrait of a sailboat etched up to a Degas dancer. A Cubs schedule followed. Family photos marched along in the parade. A wall clock resembling an owl's face kept the beat. And leading the line was a caricature that a street artist had done at a fair. Since he already thought he resembled a red-haired Pinocchio, the artist didn't need to use much imagination. His eyes were blue points, his mouth a slit, his ears question marks, and his nose pointed aggressively like a blind man's white cane. His hair was unruly. He was never going to get on a beauty pageant, but maybe his odd array of features would not be discouraged on the quiz shows he loved to watch. "Please," he'd say to the checkout girl, "what city has the highest ratio of pets to people?" If she didn't know it was Los Angeles, he'd tell her right out. But he wouldn't embarrass her. He'd say it gently, as if he were providing her with a blessing. One checkout woman, whose badge read Marta, seemed especially eager to see him on market days. "There's Mr. Know-it-all," she told her bag boy. They both laughed. Americans were very pleasant. Upstairs, the jesters were at it again. That is not what they were called, but he could never remember the name for what they were. How could two men practicing the art of silence make so much noise? Was it the rope pull or the human washing machine they were doing? Were they sizzling down to the floor like angry bacon? Or were they sentimental clowns on an invisible tightrope? He hated what they did. It reminded him of loneliness, of which he already had enough evidence. He had taken to tapping the ceiling with a broom lately. The jesters had taken to giving him free tickets to their performances. He went to the kitchen, poured lukewarm tea into a Star Wars glass, went back to the letter he'd left that morning. "I'm sorry to say," he continued, "that there is a proliferation of bad ideas here. It reminds one, if you please, of the duplication industry. For a nickel, which is very small, a man can copy anything, including his ears. However, who is it that needs 4 ears? The same with ideas. Everyone in America has opinions. I read a paper, and there is opinion on where dogs should leave their excrement. There is opinion on homosexuals adopting infants. There is opinion on facial hair and robins. There is opinion on cooking cabbage without odor. A child even has opinions. He thinks the governor is fat. Here is a large black cat in ad, choosing one cat food. If you please, why is every goddamn thing discussed in America? He would leave the goddamned out when he sent it to the personal view column in the paper. If it was printed, which it wouldn't be with cursing, he'd receive $500. But for now, it exhilarated him to curse. He pounded the table for emphasis. The red formica was unresponsive. He worked every night from 9 till 5 in the morning. His job was to sit at a switchboard that was hooked into store alarms. If an alarm rang, his switchboard would wail and he would call the police, giving them a code, and call the store owner with the news. In his 11 months of employment, there had been only 27 alarms, and most of these were due to faulty wiring. He was able to spend most of his time sleeping, just as Mr. Kaplan had suggested upon hiring him. Mr. Kaplan had been insanely happy to give him a job. Just 60 years ago, Mr. Kaplan's own father had come over here, untrained, illiterate, and if it weren't for a landsman, he would have perished. Mr. Kaplan got very emotional then and wiped his eyes with a big hanky and hugged Oleg Lum stiffly and told him, "Welcome, brother." Oleg thought Kaplan might burst into an American spiritual song. Although his job paid minimum wage, he had his days free to do as he wished. Usually, he wished to go to the library. The influx of Russian immigrants to the Rogers Park area had altered its environment. Russian shoemakers hung shingles on every block. Several Russian delicatessens displayed gleaming samovars next to pickled fish in windows. And the library had begun to carry a good amount of Russian language books, but mostly the classics. He had already read those books in Russian, which he had once taught. Now he wanted to read American books rich in history, Sacco and Vanzetti, Sally Rand, Nat Turner, and Howard Hughes. And when he flashed his neat green library card at the girl, who even in summer required a sweater, she always smiled at him. Maybe she, like Mr. Kaplan, assumed he was uneducated, a pretender to the American shelves. She never spoke, but once when he'd asked for a book on the process of photocopying, she looked worried, as if her patron might be a spy. He liked sitting at the blonde wooden tables with the other patrons. Though protocol barred speech, there was good spirit to share in silent reading. He liked watching the old men who moved their lips as they read. Maybe their false teeth read words differently, trying to trick them. And children, he noticed, read in the same way. For the last week, he'd observed a girl about 11 years old who had been sitting across from him. She always used encyclopedias and took notes. She was plump and had hair that wouldn't cooperate. It deserted its braids and bristled in front like cactus. Maybe even American plants had opinions, he suddenly thought. Have a pen? Mine's out of ink. Please, for you to keep. He handed a ballpoint pen to the girl. Americans were generous, and so he wished to practice in small ways. He kept pens and paper clips and rubber bands and notepaper in his pockets for such occasions. Thanks, she said, and began copying again. He was rereading the part in The Grapes of Wrath in which the turtle slowly, slowly crosses the road. The passage is marked by adversity, he'd have told a classroom of his students. At one point, the turtle is intentionally hit by a sadistic driver, yet it survives. In fact, the driver speeds the turtle across the road with the force of his cruelty. Oleg had arrived in America in the same way. The crueler his government had become, the more reason he had to leave. He would write an article entitled, "The Cruel Kick," as soon as he had a chance. "What's your name?" she was asking. "I am Oleg Lum." "Nice to meet you, Mr. Glum. I'm Carrie Rem." "Where are you from?" The other people at the table were eyeing them. He suggested with a nod that they move outside. Taking her spiral, she followed. "I am from Moscow," he said, once outside. "And you?"
"Chicago. I'm 10 years old and my parents are divorced. My mother always looks sad because she had an operation. Now she can't have children, but since she's divorced, I'm not sure it matters that she can't have children. I just think the operation was the last straw. Anyway, I like to get out of the house. She makes me nervous." please what it means, the last straw. It means curtains, cut, that's it, I've had it. And your mother is alone then, all of the time? Oh, she calls her friends, but she never goes out. When my dad comes to pick me up on Sundays, she looks a little better. Cars whizzed by as Lum smoked a cigarette. He liked the bold bullseye of Lucky Strikes. You would like a cigarette? He kept an extra pack at all times for his generosity training. No thanks, kids don't smoke here. You would like maybe ice cream? They walked silently to the 31 flavors, took a corner booth, and talked all afternoon. They decided on dinner for Saturday night, his night off. On Saturday night, Mr. Kaplan's son Denny answered the phones for a time and a half. Once when Denny had had a tooth extracted, Oleg had taken his place. He was worried about Mrs. Rem's grief. Losing one's reproductive ability, he imagined, was tragic for a 34-year-old woman. He might buy her a get-well card, but he didn't know that she was really ill. Maybe a sympathy card was in order, and flowers, but they'd have to wait for Saturday. Please, if you may help, he asked a small, wizened woman who looked like a lemur he'd seen at the Brookfield Zoo. When one got old, hair and face turned gray together, and fine down started growing everywhere. The woman's cheeks, chin, and ears were furry. She looked as if someone had spun a web over her. Yes? If you please, a dozen flowers. We have roses, carnations, combos, mixed-in seasons, zinnias, peonies, Hawaiian, birds of paradise, honeymoon bouquets, orchids, and woodsy spray, and dried. Can you be more specific? The woman has lost her reproductive abilities. I wish to supply her with flowers. How about roses? They cost him $14.95, and accompanying them was a card with etched blue hands folded in prayer. Inside, the card read, "With extreme sympathy upon your loss." He signed it Oleg, hoping for the intimacy of first names. No one called him Oleg anymore, except an old friend from Moscow he saw now and then at the washing well. Sometimes it was hard to remember that Oleg was his name. In extreme sympathy, he repeated, liking especially how the word extreme looked in italics. They were a marvelous invention. He hoped for an entire evening of wavy, italic emotion. When he caught his reflection in shop windows, his nose appeared optimistically upturned, and the bouquet he held, wrapped in paper depicting a trellis of ivy and roses, waved like a banner. "Get the door," he heard through the wood after he'd been buzzed into Claire Rem's apartment building hallway. Claire was a lovely name. It reminded him of water. When Carrie opened the door, she appeared cross. "You're on time. I thought you were the pizza. I was hoping it would come first." "I am not pizza. However, it is good to be here." He hoped she wouldn't assume the flowers were for her. He hid them behind his back. Since she didn't ask what he was holding, he knew she understood. "Mom, it's Mr. Glum." "Who?" She sounded confused, but her voice was melodic, a song, a tribute. "My friend, Mr. Glum." Never, he thought, had so much natural beauty been wasted on such a negligent caretaker. Not on the American side of Niagara Falls, not in those Tennessee caves where stalagmites and stalactites are overwhelmed by teepees and imitation Indian blankets. Claire Rem had blue eyes, shiny black hair one usually saw in Japanese women, and a complexion somewhere in the range of infant pink. She wore furry slippers, blue jeans, a sweatshirt that said Speedwagon, and no makeup. Her hair wasn't combed, but stuck over one ear as if it had been glued there. Her eyes looked dried up, like African drinking holes. "For you, Mrs. Rem, with thanks," Oleg extended the flowers in a shaky hand. "Who are you?" she asked, peeking over the flowers. She had the look of someone who doesn't care she's being observed, a look he'd seen on sleepers and on drunks. "I am Oleg Lum, friend of Carrie." "Well, I'm sorry, Mr. Lum. I thought Carrie had invited a child." "It is no problem. I eat very little, like a child." He smiled so hard he thought his face might crumble. "You don't understand, Mr. Lum. I've ordered a pizza. I assumed you two would eat and watch TV while I read a book." Her thin neck wobbled. "The plans can exist. And may I ask, what book is engaging you?" "Pride and Prejudice. I haven't read it since college." "Is tale of civil rights movement or of women's movement?" "Pride and Prejudice." Claire laughed and called Carrie. Why didn't you explain, Care?" Carrie shrugged her shoulders and left the room again. He pointed the flowers in Claire's direction and she finally took them. "Please," he said, "if problem, I can exit." "No, Mr. Lum, the pizza should arrive soon. Would you like a beer?" She had put the flowers on a silver radiator. "May we plant the flowers?" Oleg asked. "Oh," she said, and told Carrie to get a vase and water. Lum wasn't certain, but he thought maybe she was smiling ever so slightly, like someone who was trying not to laugh at a joke. While Carrie and Claire sat on the couch, Lum sat in an oversized tan corduroy chair that made him feel fat. He assumed that the chair was Mr. Rem's and that Mr. Rem was a large man with bristly hair like Carrie's. He wondered if it made Carrie sad that he was sitting in her father's chair. He would have asked, but Claire and Carrie were watching Dance Fever. They concentrated on it like scholars at the Moscow Institute of Technology. "It's good for fashion education." "You bet," Carrie assured him. Claire watched the television and absentmindedly dissected the pizza, which sat in the middle of the floor. Carrie had placed the roses next to the pizza in a green vase that hid their stems. He wondered whether Claire might reach for pizza and come up with a rose. The room appeared freshly painted, meaning that everything had been taken down and the walls whitewashed. No decorations had been rehung where picture hooks and curtain rods waited. It looked as if a civilization had perished there. The place made him feel foolish. It was not the first American home he'd visited. Mrs. Kaplan's was, with its plastic-covered everything and miniature dog statues and candelabra. But hers could have been the aberration. Suppose Americans were more like Danes in character than he'd imagined. Melancholic, spare, and joyless. During a commercial, he spoke. "Mrs. Rem, your daughter is a very clever girl and hard worker at library. She tells me about you. She is sorry for you." "She is?" The voice was shrill, a verbal grimace. "She is sad that you are not able, may I say, to reproduce." "Carrie, why did you tell him that?" The entire room vibrated with new energy. He imagined lamps crashing to the floor. Carrie shrugged her nonchalant shoulders. "I am sorry, Mrs. Rem, to cause this trouble. She is loving you and wanting to be of help." Now Claire was smiling and Carrie exhaling. It couldn't have been his explanation. Some signals, he imagined, like those third base coaches used to coax on their runners, must have been exchanged in the blink of an eye. The blink must have been invented for such a purpose. What had happened in the invisible moment was a detente. Finally, Carrie spoke. "Mom, he's okay to tell things to. Who do you think he knows?" Lum smiled. He knew he'd been insulted, but the insult was harmless. Besides, it had made Claire smile again. "Mr. Lum," she began, "I expected a little Russian boy. You know, pointy ears, fat cheeks, shorts, sandals. Instead, you walk in, knowing everything about me, bringing me flowers. I guess I must be very glum." They all laughed. It was a moment of joy, one he'd recall along with his first erection and leaving Russia. A triptych of pleasure. Claire kept laughing even after he and Carrie had finished, quacking and quacking like a beautiful blue-eyed duck until she said, "I haven't read the card. Let's read the card." She opened it with high drama and stared at Lum's hopeful smile. More signals were exchanged with Carrie, who, after reading the card aloud, stared at Lum too. Mother and daughter then slapped hands, palm to palm, and Claire suggested that they all take a walk. "Better yet," Oleg said, "a trick is up the sleeve. I have procured tickets for an event of pantomime to begin in 20 minutes. We should begin our arrival now." Claire excused herself. He and Carrie stood in the doorway at nervous attention. He could look beyond Carrie and see down the hallway to the roses opening in the vase next to the pizza cardboard. "Let's go," Claire was saying as she joined them, "or we'll be late." She was dressed as an Indian princess. Dear readers of Chicago, it strikes me, as new American, that much is made of largeness in your country. Examine, if you please, the Mount Rushmore. Here are the great stone faces of the profound leaders of men. But here is a man also. He is cleaning the stone faces. Up the nostril of Abraham Lincoln, freer of slaves, the cleaner climbs, as a fly without notice. Or, let us say, a family on vacation takes his photo. There is the great stone Lincoln, there is the tiny man with huge brush for nostril cleaning. Thus is humor, because the size of man is made small by large design of beauty. In America, I hear many jokes. Some are about women whose husbands cannot meet their desires, which are too large. In others, several members of Polish nation are trying to accomplish small goal, the removing of light bulb. Their effort is too large for the smallness of task. On a certain Sunday, I was driving with American acquaintance down the Madison Street. My American said, "You'll never believe what we waste our money on here." And it is true that in Soviet Union, largeness is always minor premise of grandeur. There are large monuments to workers, huge squares to fill with people cheering for politics, heads of Lenin the size of cathedrals, and many women with large breasts who are called stately by the Russian men. Now, on American Sunday, I look to right, and there stands a huge bat of metal. It stands, perhaps 50 feet tall, like an apartment building. I say to my friend, "The baseball is grand American entertainment. The baseball is your Lenin." "No," says American friend, "the bat is joke about wasting money. It has nothing to do with baseball." The bat is then humorous. I believe words of my friend, who is businessman. In poor or undemocratic countries, there is no humorous public art. History is the only public art. Huge stone pyramids are not meant as joke. In America, the bat of abundance is cynic's joke. Same cynic points at huge genitals of corpse. He makes public monument to frozen bat. The lover of art points to the living genitals or makes the beautiful statue like Michelangelo's David. As the huge Gulliver was tied down by the little citizens for possible harm done, so the public shows the disdain for size, even with its power. Thus is opposite humor from largeness. The bully is, yes, strong and large, but he is also fool. He is laborer digging in dirt. His brain is mushroom producing no truths. Largeness is victory and also defeat. To largeness, we prostrate ourselves, and then up our sleeves, die laughing. Thank you, Oleg Lum. I find that letter hard to understand. Since it was Sunday and Carrie would be away, he thought of calling Claire and arranging a private visit. The evening before had been a success, the pantomimists having done a version of Antony and Cleopatra in which the larger, bearded Cleopatra swooned into the compact Antony's arms. Carrie quacked like her mother. Claire cried when she was happy. Both mother and daughter had walked him home, kissed him goodnight, and said they'd treat him to lunch on Monday. If he called her now, the spell might be broken. She'd infer the obscene length of his nose in his altered telephone voice. She'd laugh at his misuse of articles. He'd not flirt with ruin. The beach beckoned with its Sunday collage of summer bodies. But he was not tan. In fact, he was pale and resembled Nikita Khrushchev with his spikes of just emerging white blonde hair. He was no older than a year and a half, though Lum might be wrong, having had no experience with babies. "Do you know your name?" Lum asked again. The sun was behind them, and he felt his skin radiating heat. He He'd fallen asleep in the afternoon, and judging by the sun's angle, he'd slept 2 or 3 hours. It was evening. People were beginning to pack up for the day. The lifeguard, who had made a white triangle of cream on his nose, looked bored. Not enough people were swimming, Lum observed, much less drowning, to give the lifeguard's life definition. Lum offered the child a piece of banana, which he greedily accepted. He mashed it in his hand and pressed pieces slowly into his mouth. "Bop," said the boy. "Pleased to meet you. I am Oleg Lum." The child looked at Lum's extended hand. "Of course, babies do not understand the handshake," he explained. "Tell me, little Bop, is your mama here?" Bop stood on tiptoe in the sand, wobbled and tumbled into Lum's towel. A cascade of sand followed him. Lum pointed at a young couple loading cans of Coke into a cooler. "Do you know these people, little Bop?" Bob ignored all questions, sharing Lum's blanket, kicking his feet in the air and humming, "Gida, gida." After an hour of Bob's company, Lum thought of asking the lifeguard about a lost and found service. He was afraid, though, that the lifeguard would call the police and scare the boy, who looked at Lum with such peaceful eyes, who joyously accepted crackers, and who laughed at the seagull's W-shaped assaults at bugs he found in the sand, and at Lum's cooing, "Little Bop, little Bop." Bop had fallen asleep at the edge of Lum's towel, sucking the corner he held in his fist. Lum folded another triangle over his back to protect it from the waning sun. When the lifeguard was tying up his boat and the sun had changed to a forgiving twilight in which couples twisted together on blankets or faced each other with their legs folded Indian style to share a joint, Lum realized that there were no families left to step forward and claim Bop. It was clear in this instant that he would either have to call the authorities, men whose hands shot lead at robbers, who poked sticks into kidneys, or keep the child with him. The law would not recommend that decision, he was sure, but parents who'd forgotten a child at the beach, in the way he might leave an umbrella on a bench, weren't worthy of a search. He'd carry the child home with him. In the morning, he'd read the paper, hoping for news. And if news didn't materialize, there was Claire waiting, arms open, bereft of the ability to reproduce. She had said the night before, admiring Carrie's impressions of the mimes, that she'd have liked to have had one more child, a son. Then she'd wrinkled her nose, frowned, smiled, looked away, asked for a cigarette, and shrugged. Every emotion could be observed as it changed direction like a sailboat, wobbling to shore in cross winds. She'd thank him for the child. It was clear the police weren't needed. The lifeguard had left the beach, surrendering the safety of its inhabitants to Lum. He would not disappoint the lifeguard. He put his book and wallet and keys in his back pockets, slid into his sandals, gathered the child up in his towel, and began walking. Bop snored soundly in his arms. He'd never thought of having a child himself. He'd spent his years getting out of Russia while other men searched for lovers or wives. Now, diapering the boy with the clean supplies he had bought at midnight last night when the need presented itself, it seems he had never done anything more natural. Lum soothed Bop's rash with Vaseline, powdered his plump half-moons, and watched in awe as Bop cooed and pulled his pink penis, doubling over it snail-like and curling around his softer part. At least the parents had fed the poor child and not in any way hurt him. He was mottled, pink, plump, and clean in all places but the creases, which were easy to overlook even if one was diligent. The seersucker's sunsuit was drying in the washroom. The child had eaten crackers, cheese, a peach, and milk already. Bop pronounced milk, shoe, dog, and bird. Lum pronounced, "Little Bop is very clever." Bop pointed at Lum, wordless. The morning passed quickly. Walking to Claire's, he hoped that Bop would not soil himself on Lum's new shirt. He had even given Bop a bath for the occasion and combed his sparse hair so it stood in neat little rows like toy farm crops. He wanted to meet Claire upstairs with the child rather than on the street where her reaction might be too private for display. Suppose she thanked him with tears or fell into his arms, a crest of emotion filling her chest. Suppose she suggested marriage on the spot. Oleg Lum, the father of little Bob, she the mother, Carrie the big sister, a home on a quiet street, maybe a dog, lots of American television to cool his rapid-fire brain. He carried Bob, who mostly smiled. Lum smiled, too. This might be his wedding day. Just a minute, he heard through the door. As he'd hoped, Claire answered. But she didn't meet him with sobs or whispers of praise. What? Oleg? His boy I found at beach. Is he not handsome? You found him at the beach? Didn't he have parents? Parents could not be located. I wait until beach closes and only drug takers remain. Then I take him home. He spent the night with you? You didn't call the police? I do not want government thug with stick in belt to take child and frighten him. I want you to take him. Me, Oleg? Lum looked hopeful. Bob offered Claire a sucked on cracker. Oleg, let's sit down. They walked into the front room. Carrie was not home. Bob sat on the floor and busied himself by dismembering a magazine. I know you mean well, Oleg, but laws are strict. If a child is lost, he must be given to the authorities. They'll find his parents. Parents dump child on beach like trash. They leave him there. Why should such parents have themselves found? It's true, Oleg, but there are laws. I wouldn't be surprised if his damned Easter picture weren't being flashed on every newscast. There's no damned flashing. I watched last night and news today. Oleg, Claire continued, you could be considered a criminal. It's no crime to help little Bob and to hope that you will also help. How do you know his name? I ask him, baby, what is your name? He says, Bob. Oleg, Bob isn't an American name. Bob isn't any kind of name. Babies make sounds. Bob is not name, parents are not caring, police are not called. What should I do? Take baby back to beach? Leave him in rowboat like Moses? No, Oleg, I'll call the police. They'll come for him and find his parents or relatives. You are very kind to care for him. Bob is lucky to have found you, Oleg. She kissed the crown of his head. Please, before police, let us sit together and watch Bob. Claire sat down next to him and he took her hand. Bob was pretending to water some violets with an empty watering can. Then he sat down opposite Oleg and insisted, plainly, on milk. Claire got a small glass and offered it to Bob. He is needing help, Oleg suggested and held the glass for him. They sat, hand in hand, for an hour, Oleg enjoying the most mundane fantasy. They were at an American pediatrician's, taking their child for a checkup. She was the bride he'd met in college. She still wore her modest wedding ring, though he'd have liked to have been more extravagant. She didn't have to talk, his wife of many years, just sit and admire their little son. Police are not needing to be called. I'll call them now, Oleg. I'll explain. You go home, and I'll phone you after they've left. Lum felt large tears forming under his lids. He watched Bob shredding the interior design magazine. The blurry room lost its sofa, its draperies, its rug. Everything was in pieces. This was not to be his wedding day. Dear Personal View, everything in America gets lost, sometimes stolen. I lose my umbrella on L train. It is never returned. Meanwhile, baby is left on beach to weather, danger, criminals, drug takers, God knows. Parents come to police, say they are sorry, so baby is returned. Why in America is easier to find lost baby than umbrella costing $9? But I worry most for Sandy American baby who is found on beach like walking rubbish heap called Bop. He is dirty, hungry little immigrant. I give him new life visa, which police revoke. The switchboard was howling. An alarm had gone off at Cusper Motors, but Lum closed his eyes and listened as the howling continued. He was not going to call the police. Let the thieves do as they wished to Cusper's Fords. The police were worse than criminals. They were blind men, liars, fools. Lum disconnected the phone, and in the sudden silence, he willed his eyes closed and tried to fall asleep. He would sleep until his shift ended, until all Mr. Cusper's Fords were taken, until the police were running over the whole city in search of car thieves and drug takers and lost babies.
That's it. What's your first reaction? What's this story about?
Strange sense of values.
Who's?
The American people. We value our umbrellas and our cars more than we value our babies.
But is that true? That's from the Russians' point of view.
It appears that way far too often. But that is from his point of view, yes.
That's what it seems.
I think there are some things in the point of view that are really affected by his being Russian. Mm-hmm. For example, his attitude toward the police. Mm-hmm. There wasn't any reason given in the story for him to have such a hostility to the police. I mean, those of us who live in Chicago share it, but we all have reasons.
I think it has just general comparisons between the Russian values and the American values, some good, some bad. Example was it talked about when he was gathering little things, pens, pencils, paper clips, and giving them to people. Well, he hadn't had that opportunity. I mean, that doesn't exist. It didn't exist in his world before. So he was kind of making up for lost time, and he was going to give this stuff away as fast as he could, whenever he could, and practicing his generosity, as she said. So that was a very positive one, value that he was experiencing over here that he had. So it's not only U.S. bad values, but also good values.
It's certainly those of you who've been going to Dan's Bible studies this week would recognize him as a sort of man, a sharing person, not a man, a hoarding person. That he's a very generous nature in many ways. Why do you think that the story starts with this odd scene of the Xerox machine and Oleg Lum Xeroxing newspaper grocery ads?
Because they have to stand in line for food. I mean, they don't go into a grocery store, they don't advertise 3 loaves of bread for $1. You stand in line for an hour and get something. So I would say grocery shopping is a hardship.
Yeah, I think, that's a good point. That's interesting. What were you, somebody over here, isn't it?
Similar to the same thing. They have had no experience in merchandising. People from Russia come to our country and are amazed at what we have in the stores and the materialism and so forth. Mm-hmm. And yet he goes home to the plastic furniture. He's not seeing the whole spectrum of American life, but only one small part of it. Mm-hmm.
Could he also have been questioning whether this would last, since he was putting it in a souvenir book on the copies or something?
Yeah.
Will this continue? Maybe we'll need to save it and look back and say, remember when?
And why would he put Xeroxed copies of an ad in his book? Why doesn't he put the newspaper itself in there?
Because they're perfect copies. Reproduction.
He likes to use the machine.
I came to this country from another country. And I would have done that to send the original copy home for them to see. Now, he never indicated contact with the old country. So I don't know if that was one of his motives.
I think a possible answer to that was that he then could say that he did it. I mean, he made the copies. They were his copies. They weren't somebody else's originals, but they were the copies that he made. And he thought that was magic. You know, he thought that, I think he thought he had something to do with actual the process of copying. I mean, this magic machine, he must have done something. Valuable himself as opposed to being.
And he could stick his nickels in and get out something. There was something about the duplicating process that he really liked. Something he was attracted to, just as he was attracted to television and a lot of visual stuff, I think.
But at the same time, he wasn't really attracted to the TV.
But it was part of his image when he talked about getting married and having these two kids, and he was going to have a television to quell his speeding imagination or whatever, slow him down.
I thought that was a slam. I thought this, you know, that it was kind of a sarcastic thing to say about that he'd have to put up with TV and therefore he's going to become bored.
Well, that's interesting.
But he didn't seem to be very sarcastic. I didn't see sarcasm.
He hadn't been sarcastic.
His language was very...
Yeah, that's right.
And kind of ingenuous. Mm-hmm. You know, so sweet and open and trusting and literal, very, very literal, I thought. And his literal use of English I found very charming and compelling. Thinking Pride and Prejudice must either be about civil rights or women's rights. It's a free country. One may ask what one wishes. He does say cliches every so often and kind of twist them around and make them more literal than we tend to use them. He can see more clearly, in a way, what we're doing than we can see. He has the gift of the sight of an outsider. That we lose when we take, and you probably can too if you came from a different country, and it gives you a fresh vantage point. What about the way the communication goes on in here? I mean, one form of communication is the alarm system from the 27 places or whatever it is around the city and his switchboard. And he chooses to disconnect that communication. The communication he has with Bop, which seems so natural and easy, and he assumes is a true one. He assumes that that it rings true. Then the communication with the 10-year-old girl, Carrie, they talked all afternoon in the ice cream parlor the first day they met. Carrie and he just absolutely told each other everything to start with. And then Carrie mostly was seen shrugging and walking into the next room from then on, while she was sort of encouraging this guy to get along with her dad, I think. I mean, with her mom. Mm-hmm.
Shopping.
And then the communication between the girl and the mother, which took place in the blink of an eye over and over again. Somehow they could make decisions. I mean, instead of laughing out loud at the sympathy card, they gave each other a high five and said, let's go. There was an awful lot of quick and subtle communication, which Oleg Lum pretty much caught, knew what was going on, and felt relieved about. And the change in the mood when the mother got really angry about Carrie saying to Lum about her operation, and then something resolved and the mother got over it like that and everybody knew the mood was over. I mean, all of them were very good at that. They all knew, they could all read the vibes in the room real well, in spite of his being cross-cultural. Mimes. What are the mimes doing in there? Why do they call them jesters? And does that matter? Does it matter that he couldn't think of their real name? That didn't do anything for anybody? How did you like the description of his apartment? And was that important? The sort of affirmation of American values that his apartment showed. Do you remember anything about that?
The plastic molded seats.
Yeah, plastic molded seats.
Repair make a top on the table.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's right.
Well, it sort of hinted to me that it was from a used store kind of thing, you know, that he probably came here with not too much and was using, you know, had gotten things that we didn't want anymore.
50s kind of stuff. A Degas dancer, portrait of a sailboat, cub schedule, family photos, a wall clock resembling an owl's face, and leading the line was a caricature that a street artist had done at a fair, I guess, of him. It looked like Pinocchio. I liked all of that. I mean, I think this guy was really a sponge for this culture. I mean, he was really soaking it in. And at this point, he was really open to, he wanted a relationship. He was lonely. And I think the mime stuff was largely about mimes don't communicate with language, and Oleg Lum needed desperately to communicate with language and have language cross some lines. And he was angry. He hated the mimes. He didn't want them there. He didn't want to watch them because it's probably something to do with that communication barrier and wanting to get over his loneliness and connect with people. And the mimes were a symbol of something he felt too much a part of.
So did you bring Claire and Carrie? Why would you think he brought them to the performance then? To share a part of himself or to see how they would respond? Or? I was just curious.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's an interesting question. I mean, because he had free tickets to something.
That was probably part of his, the same type of sharing that he wanted to do with paper clips and pens. And, I mean, it was
something he could give.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe he didn't know what the mines were before he went to them. You know?
Mm-hmm. But he'd been to their performances, I think it said. He loved to watch quiz shows, it says here. He was never going to get on a beauty pageant, but maybe his odd array of features would not be discouraged on the quiz shows he loved to watch. So he does have a thing about television, and he's getting, I mean, it's an American institution that he is getting into. He says, there's a proliferation of bad ideas here. It reminds one, if you please, of the duplication industry. For a nickel, which is very small, a man can copy anything, including his ears. However, who is it that needs 4 ears? The same with ideas. Everyone in America has opinions. What do you think about that? The proliferation of bad ideas. What?
No privacy. We talk about everything.
There's
nothing sacred that's left in American culture. You talk about everything. That's very different from most other countries.
And that kind of relates to the big and small thing, and the big statues of Lenin and big plazas, and here we have bad columns. That's a very key point, I think, that there's sort of...
That's interesting that you say that. I mean, what I thought as an American was that that he was not able to express his ideas and creativity when he was in Russia. And so there's a comparison. And he was overwhelmed by how we express our ideas all the time, have an opinion about something, and we're able to, whereas they're not able to.
But I can't.
But your idea was considered accurate.
Well, both are accurate. That's right. He can't express any ideas freely. And yet there are some things that are private things, even showing affection between wife and a husband, children don't see that. And here in this country, you see them down the street. I think that's what came to me more than the suppression of ideas.
I think that's a real key, you just, to this story. When you think about it, the conversation here was pretty much the same if you were talking about the fact that a woman had had an operation and had lost her reproductive capacity.
Gosh, you never see anything like that in another country.
Right. With the most mundane, commonplace thing. And it was sort of, and finding Bach was about the same as finding an umbrella, or losing Bach seemed the same as losing an umbrella. And there was a sort of sameness, and he couldn't figure out the size of stuff. He couldn't make sense of the size of stuff. So it seemed, the whole thing is sort of an exploration of what does it all mean? What's important here? What isn't important? What's big? What's small? And he does a whole riff on big and small. Jen, you want to?
And it's also, I think, maybe tied into the opinion thing, like the cat cares about what kind of cat food, and it gets a full page in Time magazine, you know,
choosing
what the cat likes. And, you know, anybody has an opinion, and it, depending on how bigly they advertise it, then it seems important. But something really important could have happened in the world, and it would be tiny column, page 6, line 5. It's, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So then, I mean, the visually it's nice to read this on the page, but the second to the last thing that happens in this story is this little letter to Dear Personal View, and then the last thing is this work scene where he disconnects the alarm system and essentially quits his job, I imagine, since all those Fords got stolen. But the last little letter says, and the previous bit here is Claire saying, I'll call the police and turn the baby back, and, you know, I'll call you when it's all over. So he loses the baby, now he writes this letter, and then he goes to work and disconnects the alarm system. So I'll read you the letter again. Dear Personal View, everything in America gets lost, sometimes stolen. I lose my umbrella on L train. It is never returned. Meanwhile, baby is left on beach to weather, danger, criminals, drug takers, God knows. Parents come to police. They say they are sorry, so the baby is returned. Why in America is easier to find lost baby than umbrella costing $9? But I worry most for Sandy American baby who was found on beach like walking rubbish heap called Bob. He is dirty, hungry, little, immigrant.
Mm-hmm.
I give him new life visa, which police revoke.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So he calls Bob. I mean, Bob then becomes him. You know, Bob is an immigrant into this world too. Oleg can express his grief at the loss of whatever Oleg is losing, his naivete or his innocence or his openness or his hope or something. But he's sorting through this question of what's important here and what's it going to be possible to do and how immune do I have to become to my feelings? How am I going to sort this stuff out? And he goes to, I couldn't figure out, why does he go to work and disconnect the machine? Why is he so depressed? But I think we're getting at it.
Realization is coming in, you begin to realize, hey, you know, values, you know, some of these things are, just don't make sense, and they never will.
Mm-hmm. Everything in America gets lost, sometimes stolen.
I think he views the child as being taken away from him as being stolen.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. By the system.
Mm-hmm.
And of course by the police, which he's very wary of.
Well, and he had really approved of America and just... it.